I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Lynn Stegner. She's a writer. Her latest books are called Because a Fire Was in My Head, a novel, and West of 98, Living and Writing the New American West. She's the daughter-in-law of Wallace Stegner. Hampton Sides is here. He's an author, journalist. Two of his most recent books are Blood and Thunder and Hellhound on His Trail. And we are also joined by Donna Wells, who is with the New Mexico Land Conservancy. And we're here to talk about an event that's happening this Saturday, April 21st at 6 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum. It's a tribute to the Stegner family. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Thank you.
So it's very interesting to talk, I think, about Western literature and Western writing. Part of the reason for that is just because it's so rich, and part of it is because it's so marginalized. You have somebody, Wallace Stegner, who's one of our great writers, who is kind of categorized as a Western writer. Hampton, what's that all about?
Well, I think it's something that he grappled with his whole career. He didn't want to be viewed as a regional writer, per se. But he couldn't ignore the fact that he, of course, was from the West and had lived and breathed it and knew its dialects and knew its topography so well. He didn't want to be pigeonholed, and he thought it was unfortunate that someone like Faulkner could be this great writer from the South. Everyone knows he's a Southern writer, but he certainly had a much more universal audience and wasn't pigeonholed as just a Southern writer. I think one of the things that he grappled with was the idea of a cowboy literature and horse opera, as he called it, and how much he kind of hated the fact that the West was viewed as a place where Westerns take place. But he said, you know what, there's more dentists in the West than there are cowboys in the modern West, the West he was writing about. I think so. It wasn't just a marginalization of the region itself. It was a marginalization of this subgenre of literature called the Western that he was, I think, trying to fight in some ways.
Now, Lynn Stegner, what's your take on that?
Well, Wally once said that trying to define the West or define its regions was a little like trying to juggle five watermelons. And it's true that the regions are so distinctive in their individual characteristics that it's unavoidable to write from out of that holding environment. So just as the South, for instance, has its more social or gothic dramas, the West has Western narrative ineluctably includes place or landscape as one of the actors, not as a backdrop or a setting, but as integral to the novel's action. And so I think that's what was difficult for the Eastern literati to understand, was that, no, it's not just set somewhere. This setting is weft and warp of the entire narrative. And I think that Wally recognized that we dropped the concept of the Western fairly quickly when serious writers like himself began to publish books out of the West. But is Hampton's right? The Eastern publishing industry really didn't want to abandon the concept of a regional writer, and it had an effect of diminishing, seemingly, the quality of the work coming out of the West. And somebody once asked Wally, "What do Western writers have to do to escape this?" And his answer was very simple: write good books.
Right. Well, I think what you said about nature being not a backdrop but an integral character is profoundly important, because it's something that the rest of the world is very slowly coming around to, which is that it's not that we live in an environment, it's that we are a part of nature. We are human animals that depend on the land and sky and water around us, and I think Western writers got that a whole lot long time before New Yorkers did, if I may say so.
Yeah, it's a kind of theology of landscape, because the landscape not only defines or has an imprinting action on people who grow up in the West, but it also defines part of a belief system and a character, a kind of Western character.
And it probably goes a long way to toward explaining his background as an environmentalist. It's so important to understand that Stegner had like nine lives. He was a novelist. He wrote nonfiction and history, and he was an amazing teacher. But he was also one of the early and most powerful, most eloquent environmentalists. And I think that what Lynn is speaking of the environment, you know, breeding these characters and imprinting itself upon these writers, informed his environmentalism as well. And you know, he wrote these amazing manifestos in the early days of the environmental movement. He was quite influential in Washington in helping pass some seminal pieces of legislation. And you know, he's on the Sierra Club, board of the Sierra Club, and at a time when that was really just getting started as an
right.
important movement.
Donna Wells, I take it that's why you really chose Stegner and the Stegner family to honor for the New Mexico Land Conservancy.
Absolutely. This is the New Mexico Land Conservancy's 10-year anniversary as an organization, and we've just hit a milestone, a big milestone. We've conserved over 100,000 acres in New Mexico. And so obviously place and New Mexico country and landscape is very important to us. And we wanted to look back at people who had been inspirational for conservation. And certainly Wallace Stegner is one of the first people that comes to mind.
Lynn, I want to ask you a question that may sound silly, but what was he like? We know him as a writer, but not as a person.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that he was a hero up close as well as far away. I mean, it was always a kind of quiet, exciting, quiet experience to sit in a room and have a conversation with him about anything from, you know, the cost of beans to you know, finding what Hampton referred to, you know, a kind of credible, eloquent voice that could represent the Western interests and temperaments. So he was wonderful. I mean, he was taciturn. He embodied the Western character. He was a man of few words, in, you know, orally, not on the page. But when he did speak, everybody shut up. Because you knew something important might actually come out. He was extremely witty in the way that somebody really smart is witty. That is to say, if you weren't paying attention, you might miss a joke, and sometimes the joke was on you. He had interesting personal rules. For instance, one of them was never accidentally insult someone. If you're going to insult them, do it on purpose. I don't know. He was hard. I mean, at the end of a work day, which usually happened around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he'd go out and do a lot of manual labor. It was a way of sort of ambulating his mind. He'd cut, you know, a bunch of weeds in the yard, or he'd lift and reset bricks and sand and things like that to just kind of shut down the circuits upstairs and engage in what he called small muscle jobs.
Interesting.
But Lynn, I did a piece about Stegner for a magazine. It was on the occasion of a biography that came out a number of years ago. And I talked to some of his students, and his students all recall him as being a great teacher, but at the same time a very difficult teacher. I mean, he wasn't easy. He was pretty flinty. One of them, Ken Kesey, said it, writing for him was like playing football for Vince Lombardi. He was tough, right?
Yeah, I remember when I gave him my first novel to take a look at, he was extremely cherry with praise. So I went through the whole manuscript, which was about 400 double-spaced pages, and every time he would come upon something he actually thought worked, he would put in the faintest pencil in the margin two letters, okay.
Nice.
That was high praise.
Well, his list, the people whom he taught, I mean, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page. Sandra Day O'Connor, Edward Abbey, Wendell Berry, Robert Stone, Ken Kesey, Gordon Lish, Larry McMurtry. I mean, It really makes one think, and I don't know which or all of you can address this, but the question of the importance of having a great teacher. I mean, who would these people have been if they hadn't had him as a teacher? Would they have gotten as far as they did? What's your take on that, Hampton?
Well, I'm envious of those guys. I wish I had been there, too. I came a little late to the party. And I've come to the West rather late. And coming here, I picked up some of Stegner's literature pretty early on and came to admire it. I can't imagine what it would have been like, though, when you're young and impressionable in your 20s, sitting in a room with this guy who not only does he look like a great novelist, sound like a great novelist, have this amazing body of literature, but he's there for you. He's there to nurture your career. It must have been an amazing experience for these guys.
Yeah.
Guys and gals.
Mostly guys, huh?
And it does seem to be a very male-centric.
There was Sandra Day O'Connor, though.
Oh, that's right.
She's not exactly a writer, but I guess, you know, she's written a lot of opinions.
You have to be a very, very precise. In fact, I remember, I don't know if she was talking about Stegner, but I remember reading something about Sandra Day O'Connor talking about the importance of every single punctuation mark in and that kind of superb precision that good writers have, because it affects the meaning of the sentences and the flow of the sentences and things like that. Did Wallace Stegner read your work in that very close, detailed way?
Yes, he did. I remember finally confessing to him after one of my books, look, it's just that commas collapse me. And he said, yes, they do. And he went on to give me a lesson about commas. And he was very punctilious about punctuation, and it did matter. It does matter, because the meaningful arrangement of words, i.e. syntax, can completely change with the movement of a comma or a semicolon. So he was careful, and he was not a fan of the sort of free associative blog-like writing that started to erupt in his workshops during the later part of his teaching years.
As I recall, he did not care for Kesey and his style. Kesey was representative of some of that 60s literature that he didn't like. It was too free-form, and it was too experimental, and it wasn't his cup of tea.
Very interesting.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, may the next generation, the people who are 10 years old now, learn as much about commas as we did and as Stegner's students did. Let's talk, Lynn, about your work, West of 98, Living and Writing the New American West. This is an anthology of Western writers. Again, here we are with this sort of regional label. But I imagine, I haven't seen your book yet, but I imagine that Western writing has changed dramatically as the landscape has changed from something pristine to something often overdeveloped and ruined in some places.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I began to encounter as I read through these 67 essays and poems, was a kind of elegiac tone. And if you read people like Ursula Le Guin or Patricia Limerick, there's a melancholy aspect to them, because each one of these writers clearly grew up in the West, and you can feel it. You can feel the sort of placidness in the writing, but at the same time, they're aware of how much has been lost and how we need to become interdependent rather than dependent upon what's really a very fragile landscape. So it was an interesting project. It began basically as a way to say, let's stop and take a look at who we are as a region, and let's get all of the tribal members together and have everyone talk about personally, not in any scholarly, but personally, what does it mean to be a Westerner? Who are we becoming, or who can we become, particularly at the beginning of this 21st century? And it was a really a moving process, exhausting process, but I think that we're becoming better stewards, and I hope it's not too late.
Exactly. West of 98, is that a reference to longitude?
It's to the isohedral line, which is a line, a longitudinal line west of which the rainfall is below 20 inches, which means there's not enough to raise crops without irrigation. So that's where the true West begins. I mean, Wally wrote a book, of course, called Beyond the 100th Meridian, and he rounded up to make it sound a lot better than the 98th. But we're trying to nod our heads his direction, but at the same time be exactly accurate, and that's what it refers to. The isohedral line, it's called.
But he wrote a lot about defining kind of what is the West, something that unites this whole region that is such a big area. We're talking about the western third of the continent, and the lack of water was the constant theme. It's like, lack of water and the presence of wind seem to be the common factors, and certainly what that environment does to people and how it imprints itself on people's personalities. I think those were kind of the enduring themes in his Western literature.
We're talking to Hampton Sides, Lynn Stegner and Donna Wells about the upcoming tribute to the Stegner family on this Saturday, April 21st at the New Mexico History Museum. I also want to talk about something which I found sort of fascinating and beautiful. Wallace Stegner had a lifelong literary relationship with his wife, Mary Page Stegner, and you, Lynn, are also, I guess, I mean, I don't know you or your life very well, but another kind of literary partnership, and that's a beautiful thing, and I think an important thing in the life of a writer.
It is, and of course, my husband also is a wonderful writer, very well-known writer, Page, and so we had our own little family tribe, and it meant that we were all spoiled. Because every time one of us would finish a book, we'd give the manuscript to the other two and see if it passed muster. And so it was I was really lucky. We were all really lucky to have each other. And Mary was a wonderful editor. She was really tough. I remember Wally said once that the best editor is your divorced wife. Because he wasn't divorced from her, but basically you want somebody who doesn't quite like you and who's going to be super tough on your work, because that's the only way to make it the best that it can be.
And the best it can be means you get a little thing in the margin that says, okay.
Okay. You just wrote the best paragraph of your life, and he wrote, okay.
Okay. That's okay.
So this event that's coming up, Donna Wells, tell us about it.
Well, it's really exciting. I mean, not only do we have Paige and Lynn Stegner as a part of it and Hampton Sides, but N. Scott Momaday is going to be coming, and he's going to talk about his that period of time when he was in the Stegner writing program at Stanford. So he'll talk about that. And Natalie Goldberg is also going to be reading from Crossing to Safety and talking about that. Jill Momaday, who is Scott Momaday's daughter, who's a great actress, she's going to be reading from Angle of Repose, and Wes Studi's going to be there, and he's going to be reading excerpts from The Wilderness Letter, which was one of the documents that Hampton was talking about that was seminal in beginning the consciousness of the conservation movement.
And it's kind of interesting that this event is happening here in Santa Fe because, Stegner died here, or at least died as a result of an accident, an auto accident that he suffered here. And, Lynn, am I wrong in thinking, weren't they thinking of moving here?
Yeah,
and they were kind
I was
of in
just
going
to say, exactly. Yeah, he was the only place that he and Mary had considered moving to other than where they were by the Stanford campus up in the hills above Stanford. And so they had several times come out and looked at places in Tasuki, and had some good friends who lived in Santa Fe, and were really seriously considering shifting their entire homestead down to Santa Fe. So, and he did die in Santa Fe, and he was in town getting an award, and it was a car accident. So.
And he was already well into his 80s by that time. Very,
80,
very
yeah, 80. Yeah,
84.
84, very sad. I wanted to ask each one of you, because I'm fairly new, I'm embarrassed to say, to Wallace Stegner's work, so I've just been reading some short stories. What, for each of you, tell us, what is your favorite work, or one of your very favorite works by Stegner, and why?
Well, I would say beyond the 100th meridian, just because, you know, I do nonfiction, narrative nonfiction, and he just knocked that one out of the park. It was just extremely well researched. It was an important time for that book to come out with the environmental movement going on. But at its center is this amazing character, John Wesley Powell, this one-armed guy and a war hero from Battle of Shiloh in the Civil War, who came out and ran the length of the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River. And all the discovery that went with that. It's a fascinating book. I think it's my favorite.
What about you, Donna?
I would say Angle of Repose. I think perhaps, Lynn, if Wally was a little bit difficult in some respects, his grasp of the feminine character and writing a strong female character, certainly in that novel, he really was right on. And I think for that reason, that one is my favorite.
And that's one that won the Pulitzer Prize.
It did.
In 1971.
Yeah, we keep saying that he wasn't recognized by the Eastern establishment, but he did win the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, and the accolades did eventually come. It took a while.
Yeah.
And the White House did offer him the National Medal of Art, or whatever it's called, which he actually turned down because in protest to the censorship trends that were occurring at the National Endowment for the Arts.
That's right. So did Leonard Bernstein.
That was his. Yeah, but you know, the other thing, Hampton, to remember is that book did win the Pulitzer, but the New York Times never reviewed it. Not until after it won the Pulitzer.
Yeah, and when they did review it, didn't they caption his photograph William Stegner?
I think
they still couldn't get it right.
No.
It's great. Well, Lynn, what is your favorite?
I have to say it's a novella called Genesis, which appears in a book called Wolf Willow, which is a history, a biography, and a fiction. It's a tripartite. It kind of represented everything he did narratively. But I love that novella because it is so cohesive. It's a single, brutal thrust of what it means to come to a raw landscape and to have your character and spirit shaped by it and driven down by it and risen above. And it's just an amazing piece of writing, too, just to hear it read aloud even. It's about the big die-up and blizzard of 19-something or 1910 or so, and set in the Canadian prairies. And I think that's just aesthetically the most magnificent piece of fiction he ever wrote.
I have been lately, and this seems off the subject, but I've been obsessed with a television show that was on, I think, for about 5 seasons on HBO called The Wire, which takes place in Baltimore. And it's considered one of the best works of television of all time and very realistic, and a lot of the actors in it are really from the kind of worlds that they're depicting, which is drug dealers and police and underworld and education and the city council, all that kind of stuff. And I was watching the special features of one of these discs, and the creator of the program, David Simon, was railing against New York for marginalizing cities as far away as Baltimore, which by the establishment that he was railing against considers them a sort of regional literature, regional media. So it really, it's not even just the West. It's a very odd situation, which we wouldn't even bother talking about if that's not where the center of the entire literary and publishing world is.
Yeah, and that problem still exists. I mean, it is still very much like that New Yorker cartoon, you know, where everything is a blur beyond the Hudson River. But I don't know. It seems to be changing a little bit. There's major changes going on in publishing today, and the way books are being distributed, and you know, the whole industry. And I wonder how Wallace Stegner would have reacted to all that's going on now with blogs and with e-books and just all the kind of dislocations in literature that are going on. It'd be interesting to know if we could channel him.
You want to weigh in on that?
I think I could tell you, I don't think he would have liked blogs at all, just for the waste of talent that they represent. Just to have someone expend something that they have that might be artful or intelligent, but without shaping it into some kind of aesthetic whole, some, you know, like a book or a story, I think he would feel that was a waste.
Yeah.
Donna, for this event, you know, we are here in Santa Fe. It's one of the spiritual PowerPoints and all that New Age stuff. You know, maybe we can have a seance at the end of this thing and try to channel and try
sure,
to channel
why not?
Wally.
We can well, do that. It's funny that you're talking about this because, you know, blogs and so on. I was talking to somebody yesterday who's a professor, and she was saying that she gets about 30 emails a day that require a thoughtful response. And my dad was a professor, and he died before the internet was even invented. And I was thinking, what would be the equivalent of that in his day? He would have had to get 30 envelopes per day in his mailbox from colleagues or friends that required a thoughtful. You don't even get two of those a week back in the you know, 60s and 70s,
yeah,
and so on.
I tell you, this is another thing that's really annoying about Wallace Stegner is he also wrote beautiful letters, unbelievable letters. You know, he had this amazing life of correspondence.
But he had time to write them. That's the point. He didn't have to write 30 a day.
Well, I bet he did. I don't know. He wrote a lot. And he wrote, Page put together and edited a collection of his greatest letters.
Yeah.
And it's just very eloquent.
He wrote, he came in and he would have lunch. And after lunch, he would usually take a half an hour nap. And then he would walk down to the mailbox and get the mail, and he would come back, and he would answer all of that mail that same day in the afternoon.
Amazing.
Well, on a typewriter, no less. We're not even...
On a typewriter, you know, with nine fingers. Actually, he typed Hunt and Peck.
Well, a wonderful author, and this has been a wonderful opportunity, which I hope it is for many, if they don't know his work that well, to encounter the work of Wallace Stegner and the Stegner family. Lynn Stegner, once again, who's been joining us by phone, is a novelist and writer, and check out her novel, Because a Fire Was in My Head, and the anthology, West of 98, Living and Writing the New American West. Hampton Sides, wonderful author, journalist, and if you haven't read Blood and Thunder or Hellhound on His Trail, ladies and gentlemen, go down to your local independent bookstore and pick those up, or your local library. And Donna Wells with the New Mexico Land Conservancy, which is on the web at nmlandconservancy.org. And once again, the event this Saturday, April 21st at 6 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum. Lots of authors, lots of amazing things that we're going to hear. Thank you all so much.
There will be a book signing after the event is over, too. So you'll have an opportunity to buy books at the event and have these wonderful people sign those books afterwards.
By you, Hampton Sides, and by the other authors there. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, all of you, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Judy Goldberg. She's founder and executive director of the Youth Media Project, and Katie Gross is education coordinator there. She's an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer. And Ryan Lawless is a radio producer, all with Youth Media Project. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you
for having us.
So, Judy, I want, first of all, to just give you major kudos for what you have accomplished with the Youth Media Project. You started out this thing how many years ago?
It's basically 7 years ago.
7 years ago, and you had this idea, and you have been an intrepid grant writer, coordinator of people, finder of talent, teacher of skills, and now you have this Youth Media Project with so many participants, so many graduates, and you have been selected as one of 10 youth media programs in the United States to be represented in Washington, D.C. What's that all about?
What's that all about? Well, I would love Katie Gross, who is our education coordinator and oversight of this What's Going On Now campaign that is centered from the Kennedy Center, to talk about what What's Going On Now is.
Is all about. And you see, this is another quality of our lovely Judy Goldberg, is that she empowers others. Katie, what's going on with What's Going On Now?
So we were lucky enough to be selected to participate in this national conversation that was developed by the Kennedy Center in D.C. They came up with the concept of looking at Marvin Gaye's seminal album, What's Going On, which came out in 1971.
And spoke to the youth of that time, which is a really long time ago.
Exactly. A very long time ago. And
not that long.
I know.
Seems long.
And, you know, in that album, he talked about all kinds of social issues. It was really his chance to speak about the world and what was going on in the world, as opposed to kind of his more sentimental, schlocky. Not that it wasn't good, but.
Hey.
So this was his chance to really discuss social issues and relevant issues that were happening during the 1960s and 70s. So the Kennedy Center wanted to honor Marvin Gaye and his album 40 Years Later by having a national conversation with youth media organizations from around the country to look at this album and see what's going on now. So looking at the issues that Marvin Gaye discussed and addressed and sang about and see where we are now.
War, poverty, exactly. Lack of education, inequality.
Exactly.
Family issues.
Mm-hmm.
Belief.
Faith.
Social responsibility.
Yep.
Addiction.
Poverty.
Yeah, those things don't exist anymore.
No, they've all been solved. It's really amazing.
Disappeared.
And so they're basically trying to get a read on young people and how you're thinking about it, talking about it, and making media about it.
Right.
Exactly. And also utilizing for some of the projects, they pull from the album. So they encouraged us to do remixes of some of the songs, so to bring that into current day work as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And using the actual songs and lyrics as inspiration for...
Not just the title track, but everything on the album.
Yeah, exactly. Not just the title. All the songs addressing poverty, the environment, social responsibility, all those.
And this was such a springboard for Youth Media Project, because that's the content area that we work with. And we currently work, I think, in around 12 different educational settings, whether they're high schools or colleges or working with other nonprofits. So we started to put the word out to those groups that we work with, and started generating content for this broadcast that's coming up on KSFR on Wednesday.
Ah, the day after tomorrow.
Exactamundo.
At what time? 7 o'clock to 8.
7 o'clock to 8.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have at Youth Media Project is an ongoing after-school production team. And that group, which is around 15 mm-hmm. students strong at this
17.
Point. 17 students strong, coming from most of the high schools are represented at this
mm-hmm.
point. And so they started developing material around this and will be hosting the show. We work with Capitol High School, a class there, Monte del Sol. We did a whole intensive weekend at the United World College, generating stories specifically around the faith and social responsibility and all the issues that we've talked about that there were templates from the Kennedy Center. Any other schools were generating content from?
The community college here, Santa Fe Community College.
Yeah, well, Ryan is representing the Santa Fe Community College. He's a member of the production team.
Yeah, my role is to come up with a radio piece for it, and it's not just any ordinary radio piece. It's really been something fun I'm working on. And
what's your piece about?
It's a radio piece on family issues that Marvin Gaye was talking about. It's also containing
did you
the
song.
Did
you use your own family, families around you?
Yes, I actually talked about my own family in the radio piece. And then how it also reflects just in general everyone else's family. Everyone might struggle with some family issues here and there, so.
Yeah. All happy families are the same. Unhappy families.
I have a message. Just
turns out that's not really true, but anyway.
But I think what Ryan's doing and what we encourage all of our students to do is to look within themselves. What are their own experiences? What are their own stories that are then also reflected in a larger context? And so when we connect on a personal level, it gives us this opportunity to have a certain level of investment and concern and care in the outcomes that happen in the greater world. And I think that's, if Youth Media Project has a niche, I think that would be it, and that's what we really encourage in students. And I think to a large part, it's also to speak to that things happen, and we create stories around them, and then we have the opportunity to choose if we want to keep self-identifying to those stories or if we want to change that relationship.
Very interesting. Now, when you go to Washington, D.C., what are you going to do there? Are you going to hear everybody else's work as well, or what happens?
I'm going to trip out because it'd be my first time going to Washington, D.C., and yes, we do get to see everyone's radio pieces and talk about, or not really the talk about, but we're going to see the experiences that they had with this radio piece, the goals that they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, and it's a variety of different works in media, so it's not, so we're representing radio. There are other youth radio producers as well, but also young people who are working in video and photography and spoken word, music, all that kind of stuff. So it's a chance to see how other young people are responding to these issues through media.
The analogy that it's like crisscrossing and crashing into people. It's this, you know, seeing different things and then finally talking about it, connecting.
Yeah, and presumably hanging out and making friends and really exchanging ideas for several days.
And Ryan might even have the chance to perform his story live at the event if he is so willing and brave.
Yes.
Ryan's a good storyteller. He won't admit to it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, keep your radio tuned to this station for the next 11 hours. And at 7 o'clock, turn on, if it isn't already on, turn it on, and you can hear the good folks from the Youth Media Project. Now, the show is called Audio Revolution.
Mm-hmm. That is our ongoing radio broadcast that we do on KSFR. We actually additionally repackage it and put it on. We've been fortunate for other radio stations to pick it up, KUNM. And do we say other radio stations here on KSFR?
Yes, we love them.
We love KUNM. We do love KUNM. And as well as KRZA, and then what
in Alamosa.
In Alamosa,
that's a terrific little station.
It is fabulous. And then the students' works, depending, get picked up by other radio stations because we post both the shows and students' pieces on Public Radio Exchange, where then it can be licensed in other areas. And what we really are moving on this year, two fronts. One is to have the stories return to classrooms and to have them generate dialogue and led by students. And then on the other front is that we're training more this past year other adults, young adults, who are media professionals or young professionals and interested in education. And we have now have three people who are operating, who are contributing to this work by leading their own workshops and developing pieces by students that end up, but everything tends to end up on Audio Revolution. So what's going on now is one of them.
And I was thinking it was tonight, but it's not tonight. It's Wednesday. It's the day after tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So keep your radio tuned in for the next 59 hours.
Quick on the math, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah. Wow.
That is a great
idea. 7 o'clock on Wednesday. And I
just want to invite people, if they're interested, if this appeals, we always do listening parties. We actually come around, and our office now is within the wonderful Warehouse 21 facilities, where we have an office and access to media facilities, recording studio. And we're actually doing an event as well for people to send off this crew who are being sponsored and supported to go to D.C. So that's Katie and Ryan and Ari Rapoport from the master's program, who is going to be attending the big event in D.C. at Kennedy Center.
He unfortunately couldn't make it today because he is in school.
He's prisoned by the schoolwork.
Yeah.
Yes, well, that will happen. Judy Goldberg is founder and executive director of the Youth Media Project. Katie Gross is education coordinator and AmeriCorps VISTA volunteer. Ryan Lawless, radio producer. Have a wonderful time in Washington, D.C. I will be listening to you on Wednesday.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
Shout out to
Thank
Ari.
Thank you so much. Yep.
And what is the website?
youthmediaproject.org.
That's easy enough.
It is so easy. And come visit us.
Excellent. I'd like now to welcome to the program Kelly Hill. She is volunteer coordinator for Kitchen Angels. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. Thank you so much for having me. So let's talk for a moment. There's a big event happening later this week with Kitchen Angels, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But Kitchen Angels is quite an extraordinary organization. What do you guys do?
Well, our mission statement is dedicated to providing free nutritious meals to our homebound neighbors living with chronic and terminal illness. So essentially, we have about 280 volunteers who prepare fresh food and deliver it to people who are in need. And that's about 129 clients a day.
And that's a lot of people. Do your volunteers go to a kitchen where you guys have a whole setup for how you prepare the food?
Yes, we have a commercial kitchen. It's on 1222 Siler Road, and we've got two shifts. So one shift is from 10 to 12, and the other shift is from 1 to 4, and those are the two kitchen shifts that we do. And so our meals are baked and cooked fresh every day from scratch.
Now, when you say nutritious meals, what do you mean?
I mean that we don't do processed foods. We get fresh produce from different farms all over, and we try to use organic when possible. So we really try to use fresh produce and local produce and no processed food.
So probably they eat healthier at home if they're sick than they do in the hospital.
Absolutely.
Just my guess.
Absolutely, yes. And part of our mission is to make sure that people can stay home. A statistic that we got recently was that an overnight stay at the hospital on average is about $1,900. To fix a fresh meal for one person over a year costs Kitchen Angel about $2,000.
Oh my goodness.
So to keep people at home and out of critical care, out of the hospital, to keep them in a place that they're familiar with their pets, with their surroundings, also helps for longevity. So, we're also hoping to impact how often people are going into the hospital.
Longevity, and above all, happiness and comfort.
Yes. Yes.
So as volunteer coordinator, I mean, you've got a lot of volunteers.
Yes, about 280 volunteers and three different shifts who are all cooking, preparing meals, and then delivering them. So a lot of dedicated people. We have a few people who have been with Kitchen Angels for 18 years. So there are a lot of dedicated people that make Kitchen Angels work. There are only four full-time employees.
Amazing.
Yes.
Now, you've been there for less than a year. A lot of people have been there for a while. What are some interesting stories that you have witnessed in the time that you've been there?
Well, I think the dedication in general, yesterday was one of those crazy hectic days where our lovely kitchen manager, Teresa, wasn't feeling good and was homesick, and all of the kitchen people who were there have been there for a long time. Everybody just jumped in and knew what to do and made it all happen, and it was just spectacular to see everybody jumping in and making it work when we were all kind of scrambling to make things happen. I've also just heard amazing stories about the friendships that have grown out of people delivering to folks over the years. They keep an eye on them. They're really our eyes and ears that let us know how clients are doing, if they need other things. We take dog and cat food to people on Tuesdays so that they can keep their pets close to them as well and make sure they're getting fed. So there's just a lot of tremendous. There was just a woman recently actually who passed away. She was 96. Her name was Ruth. And she was the original icon for... I'm forgetting her name at the moment. She's the woman, the We Can Do It, out of the World War II. She did the she flew B-52 bombers, and she was just an amazing icon. And the one of the people that delivered to her on a regular basis basically was taking care of her in the last stages of her life and was doing pretty much everything for her. Her whole family knew who he was, and just some amazing friendships.
That's
Rosie
really
the Riveter. That's who I was thinking.
She was the model for Rosie the Riveter?
Yes, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So there is an event coming up, and that is, let's see, it's this coming Thursday. It's called Angels Night Out, Thursday, April 19th. It's a Kitchen Angels thing. And how does it work? Basically, if you eat in a restaurant, the participating restaurants will give money to Kitchen Angels?
Yes. We have a generous group of restaurants this year. There are 29 restaurants. You can find that list of restaurants at kitchenangels.org. And each of those restaurants will give 25% of their proceeds for that night to Kitchen Angels.
And I have to say that some of my very favorite restaurants of the city are there. Vinaigrette is on it. Jumbo Cafe is on that list. La Boca is on the list. Andiamo, El Maison. So basically, you can't go wrong.
No, and this year we actually have two places that are doing breakfast and lunch, which are Crumb Packers Cafe and also Cafe Olay. So those two places will be doing breakfast and lunch for those people who it's easier for them to get out at those times.
And do you work with any of the restaurants in terms of food?
No, we have had a few restaurants that have done special events and have leftover large things that have not been touched, large dishes of lasagna or things like that, who have brought them to us. But mostly we make most of it ourselves and then get food from, like I said, the local farms and some other places.
Now, are you always looking for new volunteers?
We are always looking for new volunteers. We have two orientations a month. The next one is coming up on April 18th, which is a Wednesday from 3 to 4:30. Anyone who wants to participate in Kitchen Angels is welcome to call at any time. That number is 471-7780. And we love for people to come in and do an orientation and jump in the kitchen or help deliver.
And if you want to volunteer, do you have to know how to cook?
No, not at all. We go through a skills training as well during the orientation, basic cutting skills, go through the kitchen, show you everything. We're not going to throw you into something you're not comfortable with. And most people get rotated through a little bit of everything, cooking, prep work, just preparing packaging meals, doing the dishes. So there's all kinds of things to be done.
And then, of course, driving.
Yes, and delivery.
And so driving, if you're going to do delivery, you basically kind of have to be a people person in the sense that you've got to be ready to encounter people who are at all stages of health and illness and family situations.
Absolutely. And we don't expect, we're not there to provide care in any way, but there is always the clients who really enjoy having some time to talk. So that's really up to the driver, but a lot of good connections come out of that.
Kelly Hill is volunteer coordinator with Kitchen Angels, and once again, Angels Night Out is this coming Thursday, the 19th of April, and the list of restaurants can be found at kitchenangels.org. You go to calendar, and it'll say all the things that are going on there, including the names of all of these restaurants, Asian restaurant, Los Amigos, Mariscos, many, many more. So, Kelly, thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.